What a friend we have in Jesus. Aren't you glad for that? But friendship has two sides, doesn't it? Because if you have a friend who does not let you down, to be a friend, you don't want to let that friend down, do you? Friendship is mutual. It was the first week in August when I mapped out this sermon series on the life of David and scheduled this Sunday to be about the story of David and Bathsheba. And at that time, the media was filled with accusations and allegations against Bill Hybels about sexual misconduct. And many of us were shocked that the allegations even came forward. We didn't want to believe those allegations. Bill resigned and denied all the charges, and he left 40 years of ministry with a cloud of suspicion hanging over his head. But that wasn't the end of it, because more women came forward and the charges against Bill became even more serious. And before it was over, the entire leadership team at Willow Creek, Steve Carter and Heather Larson, the pastors who are on the screen with Bill there, and the entire elder board apologized to the congregation and resigned. Willow Creek's attendance dropped 15 to 20%. Their giving plummeted. They had to hire lawyers. They will be years recovering from this damage. Bill Hybels is closed off from the world right now, not even talking to his closest friends. His 40 years of ministry and of serving the Lord around the world has ended in disgrace. And some of the pastors that I coach would say, "Dick, I can't believe it," but their shocks turned to sadness. And they said, "Dick, who do I believe, the women, or do I believe Bill, who denies all these things about what happened behind closed doors?" And my answer was, it doesn't matter what happened behind closed doors. Bill was never supposed to be alone behind closed doors in hotel rooms and in his vacation home with women that were not his wife. Bill violated his own policy on gender relations and put himself in harm's way. And after 40 years of faithfully serving the Lord, he's lost everything. I hope you're praying for Bill Hybels. And I hope you're praying for Willow Creek Church as Bill struggles with his relationship with his wife and his children and his future. And as this church struggles to recover and to serve the Lord coming out of the wreckage done by one man's sin. Bill and I started our ministries at the same time, only a few miles apart from each other. One of my heroes when I was preparing for the ministry was a man named Gordon MacDonald. And Gordon was the president, well, he was the pastor of the largest church in New England, where I lived before I came here. He became the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. He was the president of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. I read all of his books. I went to all of his seminars. He was my role model. I wanted to be like Gordon MacDonald. That's a picture of Gordon with his wife, Gail. And when the news broke that Gordon had an affair with a high school sweetheart, my world kind of crashed around me. It's like, if Gordon MacDonald can fall for sexual sin, what hope do I have? And I was afraid for my ministry. And I began to read everything that I could put my hands on about how to stand sexually pure and morally strong in the long run. And studied everything I could, including the story of David and Bathsheba this morning. And prayed, "Lord, whatever it takes, I want to live for you. I don't want to end like Gordon. I don't want to end like David. I don't want to end like Bill Hybels." So 35 years ago, I made some commitments based on biblical principles to God. And because those commitments have allowed me to live a sexually pure life and ministry, I want to share some of those with you this morning as God calls all of us to sexual purity. Our story comes from 2 Samuel chapter 11. You can follow along on the insert inside your program, or it'll be on the screen behind me. 2 Samuel chapter 11. I know it's a story many of you heard many times, but let's listen to it with fresh ears this morning and see what the Lord has to say to each one of us. The following spring, the time of year when kings go to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to destroy the Ammonites. But David stayed behind in Jerusalem. Late one afternoon, David got out of bed after taking a nap, and he went for a stroll on the roof of the palace. As he looked out over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told, "She is Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent for her, and when she came to the palace, he slept with her. Later, when Bathsheba discovered that she was pregnant, she sent a message to inform David. So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And when Uriah arrived, David asked him how the war was progressing, and then he told Uriah, "Well, go on home now and relax." But Uriah wouldn't go home. He stayed that night at the palace entrance with some of the king's other servants. And when David heard that Uriah had done, he asked, "What's the matter with you? Why didn't you go home last night after being away for so long?" And Uriah replied, "The armies of Israel and Judah are living in tents. How could I go home to wine and dine and sleep with my wife?" "Well, stay here tonight," David told him, "and tomorrow you may return to the army." So Uriah stayed in Jerusalem, and David invited him to dinner and got him drunk, but even then he couldn't get Uriah to go home to his wife Bathsheba. So the next morning David wrote a letter that instructed Joab, who was the general of his troops, "Station Uriah in the front lines where the battle is fiercest, and then pull back so that he will be killed." So Joab assigned Uriah to a spot where he knew the enemy's strongest men were fighting. And when Uriah was killed along with several other Israelite soldiers, then Joab sent a battle report to David, and he told his messenger, "Report all the news of the battle to the king. Then tell him Uriah the Hittite was killed too." So the messenger went to Jerusalem and gave a complete report to David. "Well, tell Joab not to be discouraged," David said. "The sword kills one as well as the other. Fight harder next time and conquer the city." When Bathsheba heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. When the period of mourning was over, David brought her into the palace and she became one of his wives. Then she gave birth to a son. But the Lord was very displeased with what David had done. Marital infidelity, whether it's sex before marriage or sex outside of marriage, or whether it's pornography, touches every one of our lives. One in every six evangelical Bible-believing Christian men is addicted to pornography. And the number of women addicted to using pornography is rising as well. 40% of practicing Christians admit that they had sex before marriage. This is a problem which is in the church and is part of every church. It touches every one of our lives. It's not that we don't know God's rules. It's that we choose not to obey this rule, not to take it seriously. And so I have become to believe that the critical element in maintaining spiritual sexual purity is that we never make it a priority. We never take it seriously. So the first step on the back of your sheet, if you're following along the outline, is to make purity a priority. Make sexual purity a priority. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18 to 20. God says, run from sexual sin. Don't you realize that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who was given to you by God? You do not belong to yourselves, for God bought you with a high price. So you must honor God with your body. So let me ask you, what part of run from sexual sin isn't clear? I've asked myself, why is it that Christians take this so lightly when God takes it so seriously? And unfortunately, I believe part of it is because of bad theology. You will hear good and sincere Christians say something like, well, all sin is equal in God's eyes. Sexual sin isn't worse than other sin. I'm sure you've heard that. Maybe you have thought that. Maybe you have believed that. That's only a half truth. Yes, it's true that all sin is equal heinous in God's eyes. All sin equally separates us from God. And all sin can equally be covered by the blood of Jesus Christ. But not all sin is equal in its impact, in its effect, in its outcome, in its consequences. And we all know that. Don't we all know that some sins just have more serious consequences than other sins do? Some sins hurt us more. Some sins hurt other people more. And some sins cause collateral damage. Now, God says sexual sin is different from other sins. And the consequences are so bad you should run from it. Let's go back and look at the verse. God says run from the sexual sin. No other sin so clearly affects the body as this one does. Did you hear that phrase? No other sin. Sexual sin is not the same and equal to and no worse than any other sin. As the NIV says, whoever sins sexually sins against his own body. God says sexual sin is not the same and equal to as all others, no worse than other sins. He says the consequences are so bad, run from it. To avoid those consequences, all of us, men, women, and children, need to make sexual purity a priority, because when temptation is raging, it's too late to decide what your priorities are and where your boundaries are, because your cravings are going to scream louder than your convictions. You need to settle this in advance. You need to know what your priorities and your principles are. You need to know what the boundaries are that you will not cross, so that when temptation hits, the priorities are there to guide you. Because if you do not make sexual purity your priority and a commitment, then that decision will be made just not by you. Your hormones will make that decision. Your friends or your circumstances will make that decision, or that broken, hurting little part inside of you will make that decision, and you will be defeated and crippled by sexual sin. Am I being clear? Am I being as clear as God is? Make sexual purity a priority. Now, how do you know if you make sexual purity a priority? If you make it a priority, there's five things that you will commit to never do. And those are the five commitments that I made many years ago. And those are the five nevers that I share with you today that I believe come from this passage that can help all of us live with sexual purity from this day forward. The first step is to never drop my guard. Never drop my guard. Fresh from the battlefield victories, David is at the peak of his popularity. He has fame, he has wealth, he has power, he has comfort. And surrounded by all of that success, David gets spiritually sloppy and he drops his guard. Because we read the time of year when kings go to war, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. What's David doing in the palace? He should be in the battlefield with his men. Instead, he's in Jerusalem, in the palace, in bed, taking a nap in the middle of the day. It's unguarded leisure time, and that's when temptation struck. And isn't it true that that's when temptation strikes most of us, in our unguarded leisure time? You know, it's late at night, and you're all alone, and a businessman on the road, on a trip again. Or you're at home, and it's the middle of the afternoon, and you're home all alone, and you're restless, and you're bored, and your mind is wandering, and your guard is down, and then wham, you get sucker punched by temptation. In unguarded leisure, you let your guard down. That's why God says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, if you think you are standing strong, be careful, for you too may fall into the same sin. God says, don't drop your guard. When you think you are strong enough, that's when temptation will hit you. Gordon MacDonald, who I talked about earlier, wrote a whole book about his fall and recovery. The title was something like Broken World. And he said, your place where you're going to fall is an unguarded strength. He thought, the one place that I will never fall will be betraying my marriage vows. And he said, it's an unguarded, what you think is your strength can become your greatest weakness. It was a few years ago, a very important article was published in the American Journal of Business Ethics. And the title of it, in the secular journal, was The Bathsheba Syndrome. And what they did was they researched leaders who had failed morally and ethically in all different realms, business leaders, political leaders, religious leaders, to discover the causes and the cures for ethical failure. And they said the most important and the very first element in avoiding ethical failure is realizing that it can happen to you. Realizing that under the right circumstances, you can fail sexually. And you can fail morally. The best way to avoid ethical failure, they said, is to never forget that you can fail. Never let your guard down. The second step, the second never, never excuse my weakness. Never excuse my weakness. Apparently, David always had a weakness for pretty women. But when he became a national celebrity, all of a sudden, he's got throngs of young female groupies throwing themselves at him. So what did he do? Did he resist? No, he excused and he indulged. We read in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 13, David married more wives and concubines. A concubine is a woman who is used to fulfill the sexual pleasures of a man. Today we would politely call them, say the man has a mistress. What's David doing? He's always had a weakness for sexual temptation. He's excusing it. He's indulging it by taking mistresses. And David can legitimately say, I haven't violated the command, I haven't committed adultery with another man's wife, which he hadn't yet. But he hadn't been faithful to his first wife either. He has a weakness in the area of sexual temptation, and is he excusing it, is he indulging it, and the more he excuses it, the stronger the temptation becomes. David's sin with Bathsheba was the result of excusing and indulging. Well, boys will be boys. That's just who I am. Until the temptation became too strong for him to handle. And the same is true in our lives. Sin is seldom an unexpected blowout. It's usually the result of a slow leak. You don't wake up one morning and say, well, I think I'll have sex outside of marriage. But you excuse and indulge over time. You say, well, I'm just fantasizing. I'm not really cheating. It's just pornography. It's not adultery. Boys will be boys. That's just who I am. One excuse after the other, as the excuses weaken your willpower and corrupt your conscience until you give in to temptation. That's why God says, don't excuse your sexual weakness, weakness for sexual temptation. Run from it. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22. Run from anything that stimulates youthful lust, and follow anything that makes you want to do right. God says to tame temptation, stop excusing and start running from it. Run from the people and the places and the things that would cause you to sin, and run to the people and places and things that strengthen you spiritually. I know a Christian businessman. He's on the road a lot, and he has a policy. He has the hotel unhook his TV, so he's not tempted to use it in bad ways. And he has a filter on his computer, and he has a filter on his phone that screen out pornography. Not only that, but his spouse, his wife, and his accountability partner have access to that filter, so they can see what website he's been visiting and what he's been doing. That's running away, building in different layers of protection. When I was a pastor, I had the same rule Bill Hybels did, never be alone in a room with a woman. And I never did. If I had to meet with a woman, there would be another woman in the room, or there would be a door would be open, or the door would have a window in it, or we would meet in a public place like a restaurant. And whenever I met with a woman, no matter where it was, my wife knew who I was meeting and where I was, and the church secretary knew I was meeting and where I was, so nothing could be hidden. Run. Run from the people, the places, and the things that suck you into temptation, and run into the people, the places, things that strengthen you spiritually. Stop excusing your weakness. That's just who I am. That's just the way God made me. The third never is to never feed the fantasy. Never feed the fantasy. We're told in David noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was. Now, from David's bedroom on the second floor of the palace, he could walk out on a rooftop patio and look over the city of Jerusalem. And one day, from his rooftop patio, as he's looking over the city, he sees a remarkably beautiful young woman taking a bath on a rooftop. Now, that might have just been a very innocent accident, but maybe not. You see, David knew that afternoon was the time that women bathed on the rooftop. I mean, they didn't have indoor plumbing. They collected the rainwater and the dew in a water barrel on the roof of the houses. By afternoon, the sun warmed up the water, so it was warm enough to take a bath in, and all the men were off at work, so women had privacy. That was the normal time for them to take their rooftop bath. And now here's David out scanning the rooftops during the time when he knew that women would be bathing. I don't know what David's motivation was, but he could have been rooftop surfing the rooftop internet for pornography. Let's say David seeing Bathsheba was an innocent accident. Well, once he saw her, he had a choice. He could choose to turn away and walk away, but that's not what David did. He chose to keep looking. He chose to do the second take, the second look. And that's what kills us. It's the second look. It's the double take. When we start to fantasize, and we know David was fantasizing because he sent somebody to find out who she was. David had allowed his lustful fantasies to go on for so long by excusing them. He no longer controlled his lust. His lust controlled him. Now, if your life is anything like mine, sexual temptation usually hits me unawares. It's out of the blue. It's an ambush job. And it often may happen that way to you. And you can't always avoid that thought or that image. But once you have that thought or image, you have a choice. And the choice is, will I replay it and rehearse it and nurse it till the temptation gets stronger and stronger? Or will I reject and refuse that thought and that image? Will I turn away from it? Will I say, it's unhealthy spiritually, I'm not going there, I'm changing the channel, I'm going to stop that thought, I'm going to interrupt that daydream, I'm going to hit the delete button. I will not indulge in these fantasies. I will not feed the fantasy. Romans chapter 13, verse 14. But let the Lord Jesus Christ take control of you, and don't think of ways to indulge your evil desires. Don't think of ways to indulge your evil desires. Let the Lord control your mind. How? Well, crowd out the tempting thoughts by displacing them with good thoughts, with healthy spiritual thoughts. Don't think about sinning. Don't even think about not sinning. Think about what is right and pure and holy and noble and good and admirable and just and spiritual, and think on these things. You displace the temptation with something that has more power. So let's say that you are suddenly feeling your mind is wandering and sliding into the temptation to fantasize about having sex outside of marriage. What do you do? Well, if you're married, decide to think about planning your husband or wife's next birthday. That'll stop the temptation. Or think about planning your next anniversary. That'll throw cold water on everything. Or think about planning the next family vacation. If you're not married, think about your favorite sport. In other words, to say no to something, you have to say yes to something that has more power over you, is more attractive and compelling. So think about what it will be like to look your children in the eyes and say, I was never unfaithful to your mother or your father in all of our years. And I am praying that for you. Think of what it will be like to have a clear conscience before God and before the people who trust you. Think of the benefits, the rewards, and the joys of living a spiritually pure life. Don't feed the fantasy. Don't indulge. Crowd it out by asking God to fill your mind with spiritual thoughts. You can't control your feeling, but you can control your mind, and your mind can control your feelings. So you control your mind to defeat the temptation. The fourth never is never blow past the warning signs. You know, we see warning signs on the road, and we obey them because we know they're telling us what not to do, or we'll get in trouble and we'll hurt ourselves or someone else. Well, God puts warning signs in our lives, moral warning signs. David's servant tried to warn him. He told David, well, she's Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. David, she's married to Uriah, one of your best men. He's one of your personal bodyguards, David. He's one of your most trusted soldiers. Don't do this, David. This is wrong. But David's cravings are overwhelming his conscience. Why? Because he listened to his cravings instead of his conscience for too long. And that's the danger of what happens to us. Because when you blow past God's warnings too often, when your conscience is warning you and you blow past it too often, your brain actually rewires itself to ignore the warnings. You subconsciously tune out those warnings. The volume of the warnings goes down and the volumes of the cravings goes up. You rewire your brain so you don't hear the warnings anymore. And that's the danger when you blow by the warnings too often. Now, the warning signs are given to us by God for good reason. They're God's good gift to us. And our job is to pay attention to those warning signs. So what are the three warning signs to look out for? The first is toying. It's when you're toying with temptation. You say something like, well, just a little won't hurt. In the story, we're told that David sent for Bathsheba. What is David doing? He's toying with the temptation. In his mind, he's saying, well, I just want to meet this lovely lady, have a nice dinner with her, show her a little bit of the palace, get to know her a little bit. Nothing's going to happen. But at the same time, he's creating an opportunity for something to happen because he's inviting her to a secret meeting when her husband doesn't know about it and they're all alone, and so something could happen. He's toying with temptation. Saying nothing will happen even while he's creating an opportunity, a path for it to happen. And listen, that's toying. When you rationalize and say, oh, I won't let it get that far, but in your mind you're thinking of how it could happen, listen, whenever you create a way, one day you will take the way. Whenever you create a way, one day you will take the way. So don't create the way. Don't create the opportunity. Stop toying with it. Toying when you say, well, nothing will happen, but. But it's not really that bad. It little bit just won't hurt. I won't let it go that far. When we think, well, a little bit won't hurt. It's okay to join in with those dirty jokes at the office that have sexual innuendos and laugh with all the guys. It's okay to surf that porn. It's okay to hold on to that fantasy and that thought in our mind and toy around with it because we won't let anything really happen. Just a little won't hurt. It will hurt. That's the story of David. It will hurt. It is hurting you by holding on to that. Whenever you hear yourself saying a little bit won't hurt, that's a warning sign. The second warning sign is hiding. Toying and hiding. Hiding is when you say, well, nobody has to know about this. David said, send me Uriah the Hittite. Now, David had to send for Uriah because Uriah was out in the battlefield. David held a secret meeting with Bathsheba when her husband wouldn't know about it. He was hiding it. And when Bathsheba got pregnant, then David had to try and hide it by getting Uriah drunk and sending him home so that he would sleep with his wife and think it was his baby. And then, when that didn't work, David had to try and hide it by arranging to have Uriah killed in battle. Do you see how the hiding is escalating? First I hide it by secrecy, then I hide it by deceiving Uriah, and then I hide it by eliminating Uriah. Gang, sin exists in the dark. It dwells in the dark. It loves the dark. Sin grows in the dark because sin wants to be hidden. And whenever you find yourself hiding things, whatever it is, whenever you start hiding sin, that's probably a danger sign. Whatever it is that you're hiding that you don't want your spouse to know about, whatever you are hiding you don't want your children to know about, you don't want your accountability partner to know about, that is sin and that is danger. And when you say, well, nobody needs to know about it, that's just a lie. Because the Lord always knows about it and you always know about it and you will carry that memory with you. And not only is it a lie, but the truth is, our darkest secrets have a way of leaking out over time. I mean, just look at how many people were heroes 20 and 30 years ago, and after their death, all their dark secrets have come out, and we go, ooh, and we looked up to them. Whenever you find yourself saying, nobody needs to know. And by the way, Bill said that to some of the women. He said, your husband doesn't need to know about this meeting. Whether anything was done wrong in that meeting or not doesn't matter. He was trying to hide. And that's a danger sign. The third warning sign is minimizing. Minimizing says it's not a big deal. I mean, it may be sin, but it's not that bad a sin. Come on. When David heard about Uriah's death, he said, the sword kills one person as well as another. Now, David arranged Uriah's death by asking Joab to put him in the front where the fighting was fierce, then pull back the men around Uriah so Uriah would be exposed and would be killed. And when he hears that Uriah has been killed, which was his plan all along, he says, well, that's warfare. That's, people get killed in battle. Yes, people get killed in battle. But Uriah was killed by David, and he was killed by David's sin. What's David doing? He's minimizing. He's minimizing the same thing we do. And we say, well, you know, if my spouse would meet my needs, I wouldn't feel this way. I wouldn't have to do this. Well, everybody's doing it. It can't be that bad. Well, God knows how lonely and hurting I am and how much comfort I need. He'll forgive me. After all, we're two consenting adults. Have you heard any of those excuses? Maybe you've tried those excuses on yourself. So can I gently but clearly and firmly remind you from the beginning to the end of the Bible, God makes it very clear that sexual intercourse outside of marriage is always wrong. It is never right. It is never excusable. You may be two consenting adults. You may be lonely. But that doesn't change God, and that doesn't make a difference in the law. You may be lonely, and it may feel good, but it is still sin, and it carries terrible consequences. So don't blow by the warning signs of saying just a little won't hurt, of saying nobody needs to know, about saying it's no big deal, or you will suffer the consequences. That moves us to the fifth never. Never underestimate the consequences. Never underestimate the consequences. We're told then that Bathsheba gave birth. Disobedience to God always gives birth to bad consequences. That's why God says, run away from it. Not because God's a killjoy. It's because he knows that when you give in to sexual temptation, it will only bring you pain and misery in the long run. He's saying it to protect you. The problem is when we are sinning, usually it doesn't feel bad. It can feel pleasurable. It can feel enjoyable. David probably wasn't feeling like a sinner. He was feeling like a lover. And maybe Bathsheba was lonely and feeling like she needed some love. But that one moment of illicit sexual passion cost David tragic consequences that he would carry with him for the rest of his life. You all have heard it said you can choose the sin, but you can't choose the consequences, right? Well, if we really believed that, if we really believed that there was consequences that you can't predict, you can't control, and you can't undo, we wouldn't be tempted to give in to that kind of temptation. Mark Twain once said there are many good protections against temptation, but the surest protection against temptation is cowardice. That's what God is saying, isn't he? He's saying, be a coward. Run from this thing before it destroys you. Don't feed it. Don't toy with it. Don't play from it. Run with it. Be a coward. You know, I have to tell you, I haven't maintained sexual purity through 47 years of marriage and 35 years of ministry, because I'm spiritually more mature than David or Gordon MacDonald or Bill Hybels. I'm not. I maintain it because I'm a coward. Because any time that I think of what my giving into sexual temptation would do to my wife and my children and my ministry and my reputation and the cause of Jesus Christ, it scares the heck out of me. So rather than making light of it, would you join me in becoming a coward for Christ? How? Never underestimate the consequences. Now, the consequences are always different with different situations and different people, and we can't predict them. But whenever you give into sexual temptation, you will suffer from the three categories of consequences that David did. The first category of consequences is deception. David invited Uriah to dinner and got him drunk. David is trying to get him drunk, so he'll go home and sleep with his wife and think the child is his. What's he trying to do? He's trying to deceive Uriah. Then he's got to deceive the palace staff about what happened at that meeting. Then he's got to deceive the army about how Uriah really got killed. And he's actually trying to deceive his unborn son about who his parent is. And all this deception began with just one lie, followed by another lie, followed by another lie. Because after you give into temptation, then comes the cover-up. And haven't we learned from politics the cover-up is always worse than the crime? Because then you've got to deceive, and then you've got to lie, and you say, well, I was working late at the office, or I was out bowling with the guys, or children tell their parents, well, I was studying over at a friend's house. Or you erase your browser history, or you buy that pornographic material with cash and you throw away the receipt, and lie and deceit piles on each other, and you are destroying your character and you're destroying your integrity. When you give in to temptation, it always involves deception. You're hiding or lying from somebody. The second is destruction. Destruction. Uriah was killed along with several other Israelite soldiers. David's harmless little fling that wasn't going to hurt anybody. And Uriah is dead because of it. And not just Uriah, but several innocent Israeli soldiers. Their sin is hurting innocent people. And the story doesn't end there, because we're told in the next chapter, then on the seventh day, the child that Bathsheba gave birth to died. Bathsheba's husband died. Her son died. You think Bathsheba still thought that sexual sin does not carry significant consequences? Because when we give into sexual temptation, something always dies. Your conscience dies. Your reputation dies. Your relationship with your spouse or children dies. Your relationship with God dies. A little bit of your character and sense of self-worth dies. Some sort of dream of who you could be and should be dies. Something dies. And when you give into sexual temptation, innocent people suffer. Your spouse suffers. Your children suffer. People that have looked up to you and who admired you suffer. Your walk with the Lord suffers. When we give into sexual temptation, something dies, something suffers, and it leaves a wake of destruction. The third category of consequences is despair. Deception, destruction, and despair. David and Bathsheba thought they were doing something that was going to bring them great joy. Instead, it brought them heartache and misery and despair. As we read, Bathsheba mourned for her husband. She had no idea her harmless little fling was going to result in the death of her husband, a man that she had loved and committed her life to, a loyal man, a good man, a man that she didn't mean to hurt. And she would live the rest of her life knowing that she was at least partially the cause of her husband's death. That's despair. Then there's David. David said, "My shameful deeds haunt me day and night, haunted by a guilty conscience about something that he couldn't hide and he couldn't undo." David's guilty conscience took away his health. He couldn't eat. He couldn't sleep. It took away his relationship with his children, his relationship with the Lord. Now, David finally confessed and repented, and he got right with God. But the consequences on David's family lasted for the rest of his life. Read the rest of the story and the dysfunction and the tragedy his children brought him. And the seeds were planted here with his sexual sin. Because there's consequences that you can't predict and you can't control and you can't undo. And finally, we're told the Lord was very displeased with what David had done. Bathsheba is grieving. David is grieving. God is grieving because God grieves when we do things that hurt ourselves, hurt others, and disgrace him and his cause. And friends, if you and I could really see and understand how our sexual sin breaks the heart of God, we would never be tempted to color outside the lines and toy with temptation and feed the fantasy and think just a little bit won't hurt. Giving in to sexual temptation brings deception, destruction, despair, and all sorts of collateral damage you can't predict, you can't control, and you can't undo. Never underestimate the consequences. And I haven't even said anything about things like sexually transmitted diseases, have I? When you make sexual purity your priority, when you commit to these five nevers, to never drop my guard, never excuse my weakness, never feed the fantasy, never blow by the warning signs, and never underestimate the consequences, then you can claim the final step, number six, claim victory through Christ. Claim victory through Christ. When we give in to temptation, we like to portray ourselves as innocent victims. I had to do it. I didn't have a choice. Temptation was too strong. But that's just not true. God promises us you never have to do it, and the temptation is never too strong. The truth is, you wanted to be able to say you fought, but you did not necessarily want to fight enough to win. You just wanted to be able to say you tried. Or maybe you failed at that sexual sin so many times in the past, you're not even fighting anymore. But when we believe in the depth of our hearts and all of our being that Jesus Christ is in us and we have the resurrection power of the risen Lord, our friend and helper, available to us to defeat temptation, then we will stand strong and we will fight. 1 John chapter 5, verse 4 and 5. For every child of God defeats this evil world. And we achieve this victory through our faith. And who can win this battle against the world? Only those who believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Do you hear that? Every child of God defeats this evil world. How do we defeat the world? By our faith in Jesus Christ. It is His power. It is His strength in us. It is when we say, God, this temptation is too strong for me, but I know it's not too strong for you, so today I am claiming your power and your protection. It's when we say, God, I know that this habit has controlled me in the past, but I know it does not need to control me. You can control me. I'm giving you control of my life today and claiming your power and your protection. And when you make that commitment that today I will never do these five things, today I will never drop my guard. Today I will never excuse my weakness. Today I will never feed the fantasy. Today I will never blow through the warning signs. Today I will never underestimate the consequences. Don't say, God, I'm never going to do this sin for the rest of my life, I promise you. Say, today I am committing to make purity my priority and claiming you as my protection and my power. Keep me pure today. And you make that commitment the next day, and you make that commitment the next day, and you make that commitment the next day. Because when you truly believe that Jesus Christ is alive and well and he is in you and his power is available to you, then you will stand strong and you will fight. And you will win. And the victory will be in Jesus Christ, by Jesus Christ, and for Jesus Christ. Be that person. Be that man. Be that woman. Be that teenager. And the Lord will get the victory. And one day you will stand before him. And you will be able to say, I was never unfaithful to my wife or my husband. And I'm presenting my body to you, Lord, because you made it and you bought it. And I dedicated it to you. Let's bow in prayer. I realize as I give this message, you're all in different places. And some of you have failed morally and carry some shame from the past. And I want you to feel God's complete and utter forgiveness. That grace we sang about is yours, and as far as God is concerned, that never happened. Others of you are caught in habits and sinful habits that you're embarrassed about and you despise. To make today, make that commitment to sexual purity. Ask God to deliver you and to give you the power. And say, no longer, Lord, no longer. From this day forward, it will be different. And wherever you are, teach these principles to your children and to your children's children and to your family and call them to live lives of spiritual purity. Run from it. And give God the victory. We ask it in your name. Amen.